From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Steve James has been making documentaries for more than 3 decades, so he's used to people flagging him down when he's filming, hoping they'll get to appear on camera. He often gracefully declines these offers, but he looked at his latest project, City So Real, differently. He saw the 5-part docuseries set in the world of local politics as a mosaic portrait of Chicago.
On this film, it was like anytime anybody flagged us down, we were like, great. What do you have to say?
Just see what we get. Yeah. See if the documentary gods smile down on us. Yeah.
Which they did.
James talks about how he circumvented then-candidate Lori Lightfoot's press team to get access to Chicago's future mayor. He also talks about going out into the street to shoot during the pandemic. But first on the News Banter, hope you're not shocked your Netflix bill's going up. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, if you have Netflix, and I know you do, that will cost you another dollar a month, assuming you have the most popular plan, not the HD plan and not the lowest cost plan where you can watch one thing at a time. So, you have the most popular plan, $1 a month. I'm guessing you're staying with Netflix.
Yeah, it's going to be $14 now, which may not seem like a big increase, but when you're talking about 73 million subscribers in the U.S. and in the middle of a recession and where people are looking at what they're spending, this is a risk. And I think it's a smart time for Netflix to make this risk, even though there is a recession and there is a lot of new competition in the market from other streaming services. The big thing here is that there is no competition from movie theaters. And Netflix is looking at the next 6 to 8 months and the landscape, and they have an opportunity here where there's no opportunity to go to the movies to put some great stuff on the service and charge more.
Yeah, they have the fire hose of content. We've talked about in the past about how this is mature business in the U.S. They're looking increasingly to overseas subscribers. They've just done a whole reorg built around Bela Bajaria, who is just coming out of the international programming area for them. She's in charge of a lot of stuff now. So this is a thing where the obvious solution, if you're not going to add subscribers in the U.S., is to bump it up. I mean, we've always expected that. Now, Netflix is facing increased competition. And I would say, argue that, you know, we have new players on the field, relatively new players. I think they're getting a little bit better at this game, some of them. And I'm looking at Apple, which, to be honest, I sort of thought, you know, I don't know if I need it that bad. You know, I wanted to watch Ted Lasso, which is a breakout hit for them, to their credit. You know, they have a hit that is a broad hit that is attracting eyeballs. And they won't, of course, we never have numbers, but you can just sort of feel it by the level of discussion. And, you know, for that age group, I think Disney Plus would be really happy to have a hit like that. And they have not had anything other than Mandalorian for that very difficult to reach millennial audience.
Yeah, Disney Plus is interesting because they have had success this first year. It's coming up on its 1-year anniversary. And a lot of that was built around the library and this Star Wars show, which is now premiering its second season. But a lot of the subscriber gains right off the bat were from free trials and from this introductory thing they did with Verizon, where you got Disney Plus for free for a year. Those are coming up for renewal. And it'll be interesting to see how many people find value in Disney Plus when it's not coming for free through Verizon.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a kid, you find value, but that's not going to do it for them. They want more. Meanwhile, as I said, Apple has come up with a couple of originals that have made some noise, and Amazon just acquired Judge Judy. And Judge Judy has been around a long time, and you know, she has been the queen of daytime, and she's leaving broadcast after 25 seasons. She's pulled down a staggering $47 million a year. Who knows what Amazon is paying her? They're not telling us. But this seems to be part of an Amazon initiative of getting more into branded content that we know what Judge Judy is. You don't have to explain it to people.
Yeah, Amazon's the interesting one right now because for many years, they kind of flailed along. They had a movie strategy where they were picking up films at Sundance and then trying to do a hybrid model where they'd release in theaters and try to get awards and then put a branded quality halo around the Prime Video service. But starting about a year ago, they switched strategies and they are now pursuing the biggest, broadest, most tentpole style properties that they can. And they've done it successfully this past weekend with Borat, which we believe is successful. They said that there were tens of millions of viewers, but just judging by the culture, you can tell that that was a hit. Then they're doing it with the Lord of the Rings series, which they're spending about $1 billion on. And that's going to be a big, big international show.
Well, it's a big international risk, I will say, but go on.
Well, it's at least a known property that we are talking about a year in advance. So that's something. They have a show called The Boys, which is a broad comic book style show that was, at least if you believe some of these companies that purport to measure audience, it's the only show in the top 10 that is not on Netflix. And for Amazon, that's a big deal. And what they're doing is they're creating these bigger platform tentpoles to serve that broad prime audience. Keep in mind, they don't care about ratings. They care about serving the people who pay $119 a year to get free shipping and want a video product on top of that that is going to appeal to them. And they've now recognized that big, broad, commercial style hits are what appeals to that audience.
Meanwhile, I would say HBO Max really needs something noisy right now. They really would like that Friends reunion, which hasn't happened for obvious reasons. And it stands out as, I guess, the most expensive of these services. So, you know, something needs to change over there. They're reorganizing. They have, you know, all kinds of things underway. But so far, the result is not necessarily delivering things that you and I are going to talk. I can't think of a show to say, yes, and HBO Max has this. Peacock also doesn't have that, but what they do have is the fact that they're free if you're part of that Comcast universe. And if you're not, it's still very inexpensive, but it's ad-supported for the free service. And I think during this recession especially, or whatever is going to happen with our economy, free is a very nice price.
Yeah, this past week, they announced that subscribers are up to 22 million, or users, I should say. And that may not seem like a lot, but it's doubled over the previous period. And that for them is the goal here. They're trying to amass an audience on Peacock that can ultimately someday replace the NBC and NBC cable networks audience, which everyone knows is going away. The numbers keep going down every year and the ad revenue is going down too. So, you know, it's not a direct seesaw where one goes down and the other goes up, but ultimately, someday, they're trying to create this hub that can compete in a free or freemium environment where you pay if you want no ads, you get ads if you just want it for free. And I think, you know, it's going to take programming. They just canceled Brave New World, which was the launch show for Peacock. I don't think that got much traction, and they canceled it after one season. So like all of these services, they're going to have originals that are exclusive to the service that people are going to be willing to give their time to. And this is the same for HBO Max. HBO shows are great, and they're doing a better job at HBO Max of maintaining that HBO audience and moving them over to the HBO Max product. But they've got to have something unique that is only on HBO Max that you've got to subscribe, and you've got to pressure Roku and Amazon Fire to allow the product on their devices. And it's going to get traction once they have a broad, unique hit.
Yeah, they at this point are the last people without that Roku and Amazon Fire thing. And that is a big deal, but it's a negotiation, I guess. We've seen Peacock get there and we have not seen HBO Max. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Steve James is best known for Hoop Dreams, his ambitious documentary that followed two kids from a Chicago high school who were hoping to make it to the NBA. The film took almost 7 years to complete, and it won the Best Documentary Prize at Sundance in 1994. More recently, James made America to Me, a critically acclaimed series about students at a hypothetically integrated high school in Oak Park, Illinois. Now he's out with his new project, City So Real, a rich, multifaceted look at the neighborhoods and cultures that coexist in the city of Chicago. The first four episodes focus, but only in part, on last year's mayoral election.
Lori Lightfoot senses a late surge and has won the endorsement of progressives.
It is a breeding ground for corruption.
What do we do? Shut it down! That happens every time one of them get killed. They riot.
It breaks my heart. I got a room full of beautiful black children and they're all trying to get out.
James and his crew would often set out to film without any idea what they'd end up capturing. Many of the most powerful moments in the series arose from chance encounters.
It was inspired by, you know, a film that I had seen, the Chris Marker film, La Jolie Mai, the portrait of Paris that he did in the early 60s that really, you know, I don't know, blew my socks off as to like what a documentary could be. And so after being in Chicago for a while, I've been here now for about 35 years, I thought it would be great to try and do something along those lines, a kind of portrait of the city with the same kind of serendipitous approach to people and events that he did so beautifully in that film. And so the idea of it being a mosaic was something that was in my mind when we finally went out and did this film, because I didn't, even though it's centered around the mayoral election and to a lesser degree, the trial of Jason Van Dyke for the murder of Laquan McDonald, I knew that I didn't want it to be just that, that I wanted it to range hopefully farther and wider and get around to different corners of the city and just meet people.
How many teams did you put out there in the course of making the film?
It's a lot less than you'd think. We did have a number of people that helped with the filming, but it wasn't like we, you know, everyone got up in the morning. We had like three teams going constantly. It was nothing like that. My son, Jackson, he was one of the DPs on it and had a lot of great ideas that ended up in the series. And a lot of times me and Zach Piper, who was my producing partner on this and other films, who also does sound recording in the field. A lot of times it would be just me and him, or we'd pull in Kevin Shaw, this really brilliantly talented DP that I worked with on America to Me.
This is the series you did in a school in, I think Oak Park. It was supposed to be racially mixed school and with varying degrees of success.
Yeah,
or not.
Yeah. The equity was not happening, is not happening. So, you know, we had field producers, you know, that went out from time to time and helped us, but it was a pretty bare bones project.
You have these very beautiful emotional scenes, and I'm going to mention a couple of them. One of them is you're in this famous Daly's restaurant, and you find this, I think a homeless woman who starts singing to one of the patrons. Who's there and sees that developing and shoots it?
Jackson was down there shooting it, but then I joined later and Jackson was nice enough to let me shoot for a while because he could see how much I wanted to shoot. So, but that woman kind of approached us while we were eating breakfast. We were taking a break and eating breakfast and she just kind of came up and she said she wanted to talk and not necessarily on camera. She just was very friendly. And I saw her Willie Wilson button, another candidate for mayor. You know, this woman was just kind of remarkable. I had no idea she was homeless. I had no idea she was going to sing a song. And she just had this incredible spirit despite her circumstances. And then she went over to this patron and started singing the song. So we shot it.
Let me bring up the Uber driver that you were with. I don't know if it was you, but
yeah,
there is a sequence.
Me. Yeah,
it was you. There's a sequence in an Uber where this woman, she's a very upbeat, lovely woman, clearly. And then she starts talking about a moment of terrible discrimination and an insult that was hurled at her.
Just today, when I was picking up this lady, and I wasn't double parked or anything, but this guy pulled up on the side of me and called me a black, you know, stupid black.
As I understand it, you were just riding in the Uber.
When we would be out filming, we'd often use Uber or Lyft to get us from place to place because it was a lot more efficient than getting back in our cars. So that's what was happening. And she saw the camera when we got in the back and she said, "What are you guys doing?" And so I told her we were doing this film that was focusing on the mayoral election. And she started talking about how much she loved Amara Enya, one of the candidates that we feature prominently in the series. And she was so bubbly and lovely. I just said, hey, do you mind if I come sit in the front seat and film you? And she was like, okay. And so the beginning of that scene is about Amara. But then I asked her about her Care Bears outfit that she was wearing. And for some reason, I don't know exactly how, that led her to this story eventually about what had happened to her earlier that day with this altercation with a white motorist, and that was just awful. And we had just met her. We got to know her, and now I text with her from time to time, and she shows up in episode 5 because she texted me about a situation that had happened to her, and we went out and filmed her telling that story. And so, I mean, that was the approach to this film. It took us a little while to embrace serendipity in that way, but once we did it, I tell you, man, it's like the best way to film, I think. Because, you know, on so many films, it's very common when you're out filming that people will flag you down and go, hey, what about me? Talk to me, you know? And a lot of times you gracefully decline because there's absolutely no reason to talk to that person for the film you're making. But on this film, it was like, anytime anybody flagged us down, we were like, great, let's, what do you have to say?
Just see what we get. See if the documentary gods smile down on us.
Yeah, yeah, which they did.
So you followed the campaign, this crazy Chicago-style campaign with all of these candidates. And I almost feel like as I'm watching, I can see the dawning awareness that Lori Lightfoot is going to be a contender. I don't know if that's, I'm reading too much in. Because she truly will, you know, she wasn't really registering before a certain point in the race.
No, she wasn't. And thank God we pursued her as hard as we did, because she was one of the first candidates I talked to about, like, we would love to trail along with you, because I just thought she was fascinating, you know, with no sense that she might actually ultimately become mayor. And she was really into the idea of what we were doing, because when I would pitch this to candidates, I pitched it as kind of what it was. Like, yes, we're following the mayoral election, but that's not all we're doing. We're really trying to do a portrait of the city. And she said, that's cool. I like that. So she was interested in it. Unfortunately, her press people were not. They thought it was a waste of her time.
It's very annoying when that happens.
Yes.
I'm familiar with the phenomenon.
Yes. And so we had to circumvent them, and we did, and she was cooperative, and we just sidestepped her press people, thank God. And we started to see something happening with her, to get back to your point. It's like, you know, even though she was still really low in the polls, there just seemed to be this energy, and she had found her voice in criticizing the Democratic machine and the politicians who represented that, particularly Tony Preckwinkle. And there was just something happening. And then when she got the Sun-Times endorsement, it was like the dam broke, because people, I remember, were saying, why did the Sun-Times waste their endorsement on a minor candidate like Lori Lightfoot? Well, she was no longer a minor candidate. And we were fortunate to be able to, I think, capture that rise for her in towards the end of the first four episodes.
Coming up after a short break, Steve James talks about how he put together a bonus pandemic episode of City So Real. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Steve James, the documentarian behind the new Hulu series, City So Real. James used Chicago's mayoral election as a jumping-off point to shine light on the city and the country. After the series played at Sundance, James was on the hunt for a buyer when the pandemic hit.
We finished the series, as far as we knew, and then the pandemic hit, and everything stopped, as you know. And so, including sales efforts on behalf of the series. And
yeah, so you were all the way, like, went months without an offer for the film.
We did. And in those intervening months, when the pandemics really started to heat up and the shelter in place happened and all of that, I realized, I was like, gosh, when people see this, it's going to feel like ancient history, even though we just finished it, because the world's changed. And so we decided at that point to go out and do what we thought was going to be a postscript. But then when George Floyd, and so we started that and you know, did Zoom interviews and things like that, that you see in the first part of episode 5. And then George Floyd hit. And when George Floyd hit, we decided we were doing a full-on episode and we needed to be back out in the streets in a big-time way. And so we did. And you know, I feel like the series through first 4 episodes is entirely relevant to the moment we're living in right now on their own, because you see what Chicago is dealing with, which is what America is dealing with. The same issues, but certainly being able to go and do an episode 5 just brought it, you know, much more up to date and to this moment that we're all kind of living with.
So we had Alex Gibney, your friend Alex Gibney, on the show very recently about Agents of Chaos and Totally Under Control. And, you know, he talked to us about the logistics and shipping out these devices so they could interview people who didn't want to, either in person or remotely. But you guys are out in the street.
Yeah, you know, let me just say, I know you talk about the business of filmmaking on your show. It's like, I don't work with the same budgets that Alex does. Okay. I'm just going to say that. And, no, but it wasn't possible to do this in that way and do what we needed to do. So we exercised as much safety as we could possibly do it and still do what we needed to do. We wore a mask all the time. We wore gloves. You know, and I'm here to report that we got no one sick and none of us got sick. So it worked, but it wasn't possible to exercise the kind of, you know, high end COVID preparedness, safety shooting protocols that I think are right and should be done in every circumstance where that's possible. It just wasn't possible for us to do that.
Speaking of this business that we talk about on our show, you had a longstanding relationship with Kartemquin Films, which is over 50 years old, making films that are, you know, socially relevant films. How does that relationship work when you say, well, I'm going to do a film about Chicago? Do they look at you and say, are you really? Or are you really going to just shoot like so much footage? Or how does that thing work out? And when the financing comes in, I saw Participant is there.
Yeah.
Do they come in for a film and then they end up with a series? How did that turn out?
Yeah. With Kartemquin, it goes all the way back to Hoop Dreams. And I'm still around. They still haven't given me a desk there yet, but that's okay. I don't really want a desk. But it's a great relationship because they provide the kind of structure early on with Hoop Dreams and even especially Stevie, a film that I did right after Hoop Dreams. They provided not just a home for those films, but tremendous guidance and help them to even get made, period. I mean, they wouldn't have been made without Kartemquin. As things started to get easier on the funding front, I still go through Kartemquin because it's a community of filmmakers and services that works for me.
I mean, let me just interrupt and say, can you characterize what they do for you?
Sure. In terms of- so what Kartemquin does is... you know, they're a full-on production entity house. They have edit suites there. They have camera gear. They have bookkeeping. They have executive producers who do have great funding contacts. But it's also a community of filmmakers. We'll do screenings there of rough cuts and get, you know, brutal feedback. I think one of the things that's changed especially for a lot of independent filmmakers who aren't that connected is, you know, because they can go out with a camera and kind of do it all on their own now, and they can come home and edit it on their laptop if they have to, you know, filmmaking can become a more solitary endeavor than it used to be. It used to be you couldn't do it that way. And I think one of the great things about Cartemquin is that there's a genuine community of really smart, talented filmmakers there who also provide all these support services. The funny thing with Participant is that for years I was trying to get in the door at Participant. And even though I knew Diane Wireman well, I just never seemed to have a project that appealed to them until America to Me. And Diane immediately got what it was we wanted to do with that series. And at that point, they had never funded, they hadn't funded a docuseries yet. Now, it was just a matter of time, of course, but it just hadn't happened yet. And she's told me, she said, I really love this, and I'm going to see if we can't push this through, even though we've not done a docuseries before. And so she made that happen. In the original contract with them for America to Me, it was 4 to 6 hours. And I said to Diane, you know, this isn't going to be 4 hours. She goes, yeah, I know, but just let it go. And then when it became 8 hours, she was like, okay, it's fine. It's 8 hours. And then when it became 10, she said, okay, it's stopping at 10. And for some reason, despite that experience with me, she was willing to do another project, which was this one. And it started out as a film, a standalone film. And then it mushroomed into what it is now. But I think one of the beauties of working with Participant is that they want it to be the best thing it can be, more than anything. And so that's what it became. And you know this, it's sort of like docuseries now are all the rage. And they're part of the reason they're the rage is because people want that kind of immersive storytelling, but also they work for buyers because, you know, the price per hour of content is usually considerably lower than it would be for a standalone documentary. And so they can offer you more money than you might normally get for a standalone documentary. And it works for them and it works for the filmmaker if the filmmaker, you know, is economically minded like I am, and am a really cheap filmmaker, inexpensive filmmaker, not cheap.
Yes, inexpensive. Yeah, you are
a bargain.
I imagine editing is like probably one of your biggest expenses in a way, man hours and person hours in terms of that, because I can't imagine that process by which you edited all this footage into the mosaic of the, you know, the portrait.
Yeah, well, you're right. One of the things we do at Cartemquin in general, and it's certainly true of my work, is that we try to make sure there's plenty of time for the edit because, you know, we really believe that the story gets told in the editing. And I had a great partner in the edit in David Simpson, who I've worked with for, gosh, you know, like 20 years now. And he's, you know, he's a phenomenally talented editor and we work really well together. And then Zach Piper, who was my producing partner and I've worked with for a number of films, he turned into just an incredible dynamo when it came to finding the archival stuff that we use, the TV stuff and all of that, that helps to frame the scenes and the story, a very important part of this series. And he just became our go-to guy with that. And he would find the most amazing stuff. So we just had a great crew from top to bottom, which you need in order to pull something like this off.
Steve James is the director of the docuseries Cities So Real, now streaming on Hulu. Thank you so much for this wonderful interview.
Thank you, Kim. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
And that's The Business. Kevin Tidmarsh produced and edited today's program. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.